Well, good morning. This morning we're into Genesis 37, an interesting passage of scripture. It has a wealth of things that we can learn, the things that reveal maybe a lot about who we are to ourselves, as well as revealing who God is. And somewhere along the way, I misordered my pages. There we go. That's right. Family history. Do you know your family history? Some of it? Some of it we know pretty well. Some of it we know pretty easily. Some of it we talk about, we discuss, we share with people freely. Some of our family history is in closets, is it not? My mom used to say, everybody has a skeleton in their closet. Or had skeletons, maybe plural. That's the family history we don't talk about very much. The things that maybe you'll hear a hint about behind closed doors. The things that are the dirty family secrets. These are the things that's hard to confront. These are the things that pass down from generation to generation. Because we hide them. We don't face them. Abusers often abuse because they were abused. And they weren't able to face up to that. And so instead of being able to deal with it, they carry it forward. Jacob has a family history. It's a family history of deceit and favoritism. It goes all the way back to Abraham, who twice lied to kings about the nature of his relationship with Sarah. Who had a sibling rivalry between Ishmael and Isaac. It was passed on to Isaac and Rebekah. Isaac picked up his father's habit of lying about his wife to kings. Rebekah instigated the deceit of Isaac in getting the blessing for Jacob. Isaac and Rebekah each had their favorite child. Isaac favored Esau. Rebekah favored Jacob. That thing that started with the seed with Abraham grew in the lives of Isaac and Rebekah. And then it dominates Jacob's life. Jacob, whose very name meant deceiver, supplanter, participated in the deceit of Isaac, learned from Rebekah, went to Laban's house, and both deceived and was deceived by Laban. He married Rachel, who also deceived Laban about stealing his household gods. And Jacob had his favorites. Rachel was his favorite wife, to the point that Leah was naming her sons names to reflect the hopes that she had that Jacob might turn some of his attention toward her. And yet he didn't. Her sons picked up on this and were trying to aid her. We saw Reuben bringing the mandrakes, trying to aid her in her quest to earn Jacob's favor through childbearing. And then the children are born. And Rachel dies. And that brings us to Genesis chapter 37. That's the family that we're going to be reading about. That's the family history. That's the part of the family history that normally stays in the closet. But God's revealed it to us. He's shown us these things. He's recorded them in His Word for us to learn from. Partly we can understand He doesn't work through perfect people. Aren't we glad for that? Chapter 37 and 38 of Genesis are going to partially be an expose of why the family can't stay in Canaan. And partially it's going to be an explanation of how God uses these family dynamics, which are unhealthy, to accomplish His purpose in growing a nation. He can use those things in our lives, which even are not healthy things, to His good purpose. Not that He wants us to live in those unhealthy relationships, but that He can redeem them and make something of them. Chapter 37 says, now Jacob lived in the land. He settled in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. Abraham and Isaac understood they were sojourners there, that they were not to mingle with the people, that God had called them for a separate purpose, and the people there were people that were under a judgment from God. It was a delayed judgment. It's a judgment that was going to, it was 400 years in the making from the time of Abraham. But it was a judgment to be coming. And they understood that. They were sojourners. Jacob settles there. He settles there among the Canaanites, a people who are willing to assimilate his family. In Shechem, the proposal was, settle among us and marry our daughters, and we'll marry yours, and we'll become a people with you. You'll become part of our people. That's not God's plan for them. Canaan was much like America has been through much of our life. They were a melting pot. You came in and they welcomed you and they invited you to live among them and learn their values and become one of us. That's been the beauty of America, has it not? That's the kind of land Canaan was. But they were not to learn the Canaanite ways. But Jacob is showing a propensity to settle among them. That can't be allowed. That has to change. And so then we turn a page to the next section of Genesis. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. We've seen before that this is the way that the narrator uses to divide one section of the book from the other. And so we know we're turning our attention from where we were to the next chapters in the story, the next scene. We had the generations of Adam, which didn't talk about Adam. We'd already learned about Adam. It talked about his descendants. We had the generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, which didn't talk about the brothers. It talked about their descendants. We had the generations of Terah, which didn't talk about Terah. It talked about Abraham, his descendants. We had the generations of Isaac, where we learned about Jacob and Esau. And now we have the generations of Jacob. And the narrator is telling us that we're turning our attention from Jacob, who's still going to have some role to play in the story. But the focus now is on Jacob's descendants, his sons. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph. We skip the first 10 sons and we move right to Joseph. This section of Genesis is going to cover the last 14 chapters of Genesis. This is the longest section of the book of Genesis, and it's by and large going to focus on the story of Joseph. Joseph is going to be our main character. Joseph is who the story arc is going to follow. Primarily. Judah a little bit. Primarily Joseph. We're introduced to Joseph when he's 17 years old. Slightly younger than Faith. Teenager. His passion to flock with his brother while he's still a youth. He's young. Literally, he was assisting his brothers in pasturing the flock. They were, quote unquote, in charge. He was assisting them. And then we find out it wasn't all of his brothers. He was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah. His father's wives. Technically, these were the handmaidens of his wives. The handmaidens of Leah and Rachel. They had between them four sons. These were the sons that Joseph was assisting. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. A bad report. This is the same language used in Numbers 13 where it says the 10 spies brought back a bad report about the land of Canaan to the nation of Israel. It's the same words, the same language. Jacob brought back a bad report about the sons of the handmaidens. The four sons of the handmaidens. The first thing we learn about Joseph as a teenager is he's a snitch. He's a tattletale. If you have brothers and sisters in your family, how well did you like the snitch? That's the first thing we learn about him. And then we find out in verse 3, now Israel loved Joseph more than all of his sons because he was the son of his old age. He was the youngest of the first 11 by quite a bit. He also was the son of the favored wife, Rachel. That's not in this verse. We know that because of what we read earlier. And so he loved him more than all of his sons. And he made him a very colored tunic. Varicolored is a word we really don't have a good translation for. That's the best translation we have. The meaning, the conveying of this is he made him a royal robe. This is the same words used to describe the robe that Tamar, the son of the daughter of David, was wearing when she went into Amnon. This is the same kind of robe. It's a robe that indicates authority. It's a long robe with long sleeves. If you live in a society where you're out taking care of the sheep in the heat, where you're working with your hands, like a mechanic, is this the kind of clothing you'd want to wear when you're working on vehicles? No. This isn't the kind of robe that you wear as a manual laborer. This is a robe of authority. This is the kind of robe that Jacob gave to Joseph. In our families, often the running joke is the youngest child is the spoiled child, right? He's the youngest child. He's favored. He's given a robe, the robe of an overseer over the rest of his brothers. Israel's indicating to the entire family, this is the kid that's going to get the firstborn share, even though he wasn't the firstborn. It's the kid that's going to have the authority. If you've been in a work situation, or maybe there was a golden boy employee, the one who maybe didn't always arrive at work on time. Maybe didn't do the best work. But he related really well with the boss, right? That's the situation we have. And his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all the brothers. And so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. If you don't know the rest of the story, if you stop there, which one are they hating? If you're in that work situation and you have the boss that's showing that kind of favoritism to your coworker, who maybe isn't doing as good of a job, and maybe he is, and you've been out here working for that boss for 10 years, and that guy's only been on the job for 2, because he's only 17. And he's getting all the special favors. How do you feel towards the boss? Are you hating the golden child, or are you hating the boss, or both? You know, the Hebrew is quite ambiguous. Those pronouns, your version might say they hated Joseph, but that's not what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew has pronouns. They hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. Hebrews ambiguous. I think it's ambiguous on purpose. Because if you think about the human nature of it, but Jacob's their father, and that's not kosher. And so the narrator is going to clarify for us that the hate is directed towards Joseph. But it leaves that lingering doubt that Jacob maybe isn't so well liked either. I mean, they already know he doesn't care much for them. Their names are a reflection of the fact that Jacob didn't care for their moms. And probably didn't spend much time with them. And they couldn't not even speak to him on friendly terms. They couldn't even have a normal, casual conversation that was friendly, that was okay. They couldn't speak to him without the hate coming through. Just don't talk to me. No. I'm just going to ignore. That's the relationship they had with Joseph. That's the relationship this family is in. That's the situation Jacob has created through his favoritism. And then Joseph starts dreaming. Verse 5, then Joseph had a dream. Verse 5 is a summary verse. We're going to get a summary of what's about to happen. So we're going to read the summary, and then we'll see the details in the coming verses. Then Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. So he said to them, he had this dream. He said to them, please listen to this dream which I have had. The English makes it a lot more polite. That listen is an imperative. Hey, you guys need to listen to what I've dreamed. These guys who couldn't even speak friendly to him. He had this dream. He's all excited about it. And he's going to share it with them. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field. And lo, my sheaf rose up and it stood upright. And your sheaves all gathered around. And they bowed down to my sheaf. Pharaoh has 2 dreams that need interpretation that we're going to read about later. There's 2 other dreams, one by the cupbearer and one by the baker, that we're about later that need interpretation. The brothers don't need any interpretation for this dream.
Joseph doesn't say, and you know what this dream means, guys? Huh? I'm real excited about this. They're not excited. They don't need any interpretation. They know what it means. And his brothers said to him, are you actually going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over us? And so they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Why did he even tell them? Why did he even share it with them? He had to know how they were going to take this, right? These guys already hate me. And I'm going to go out there and tell them, you know, I had this dream and you get to bow down to me. Isn't that good? Are we cool with that, guys? Joseph might be just a little bit arrogant here. Definitely naive. Definitely a 17-year-old. Yeah? Teenager? So now we have double hate. They already hated him. And now he comes out with his dream, and yeah, they hate him all the more. And now he had still another dream. And because it went so well the first time, he goes out and he relates this one. Rushes right out to his brothers and says, hey guys, I had another dream. Listen to this one. Behold, I have still another dream. Behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars are bowing down to me. What do you think that means, guys? Yeah, this dream doesn't need any interpretation either. They know. They get it. They don't need an interpreter of dreams to tell him what's up. And not only does he tell his brothers, because they receive it so well, he says, oh, I've got to tell Dad. He'll be excited. And he relates it to his father and to his brothers. And his father rebuked him. He was much more pleased with it than the brothers were. What is this dream you have had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come and bow ourselves down you to the ground? A little bit arrogant there, Joseph. Watch yourself. And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. That's the end of our first scene in this chapter. So we have Joseph, a teenager, apparently full of hubris, full of himself, secure in his status as daddy's favorite. We have Jacob following the path of his fathers, showing the favoritism. Blind to what's producing in his family. We have the 10 brothers. 10 brothers who have been overlooked. 10 brothers whose names remind them of the fact that their dad doesn't care for their mom. Tim brothers who Jacob has already illustrated his indifference toward in the way he reacted to the rape of Dinah at Shechem. When he did nothing. And when they did something, he rebuked them because it might endanger him. Ten brothers full of hatred and jealousy. Proverbs 6:34 said, jealousy enrages a man, and he will not spare in the day of vengeance. And Proverbs 27:4 says, Wrath is fierce, and anger is a flood. But who can stand before jealousy? Can you feel the tension the narrator has built in this story? We have the brothers whose hatred was there, and then it built, and then it built, and then it built. It's like the armies, the militia of America and the Army of Britain at Lexington and Concord. The tension is there. All it takes is a spark. A drawn bow, the arrow placed, the arrow notched. What? Is there going to be a trigger? Scene shifts. Verse 12. His brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. Shechem, of all places, Shechem. They go back to Shechem. And here is telling us by the geography of the story, something bad's going to happen. Bad things happen at Shechem. They go back to Shechem. And Israel says to Joseph, who didn't go with his brothers, of course not. He doesn't have to go out and work. He's the overseer. He's got the robe, right? Are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Now Shechem, they're in Hebron right now. We'll find that out in the verse here. And Shechem is like 50 miles away. It's like 2 to 3 days journey. It says, aren't your brothers in Shechem? Come, I'm going to send you to them. And he said to him, I will go. Go check on your brothers. And he said to him, go now and see about the shalom of your brothers and the shalom of the flock and bring word back to me. And so he sent him from the valley of Hebron and he came to Shechem. How blind is Jacob to the tensions within his family? Does he not see it? Or does he see it and assume because he's given Joseph the robe that the brothers will respect him anyway? Or does he just believe because, well, they are my sons after all, they wouldn't hurt their brother? Are we blinded by the position that people hold, by what we know of them? And Joseph, obedient to his father, he says, yeah, I'll go. And not only will I go, I'm going to wear the robe you gave me, Dad. The robe that's caused so much jealousy and hatred. And so he goes. And he gets to Shechem, and there's nobody there. And he's out wandering in the fields. And the man found him. Behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, what are you looking for? He said, I'm looking for my brothers. Please tell me, where are they pasturing the flock? They were supposed to be here. And the man says, oh, they moved from here. For I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. Dothan's another 15 miles away. So now we're about 65 miles away from Hebron. A good distance away from Dad. And so Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. And then the scene shifts again. And we could see this from the kid's perspective, from the brother's perspective, the 10. And when they saw him from a distance, and we have got the summary in verse 18, and then we're going to get the details again, like we've seen throughout the rest of the story. And when they saw him from a distance, and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. They saw him from a distance. They saw him come. They could see, spot that robe from miles away. It was obvious. So they saw him coming and said, here comes the dreamer. Yeah, sarcasm there. Just a little bit. A lot of that hatred, a lot of that jealousy coming out. Says, you know, we're a long ways from home. We have wilderness between here and there. Let's kill him. Let's kill him. We'll throw him in a pit. Nobody will find the body. And we'll say, a wild beast has devoured him. And then let's see what becomes of his dreams. The anger and the jealousy are being released. But Reuben, the firstborn. Reuben, the firstborn that had forfeited his right to moral authority when he slept with his father's handmaid, Rachel's handmaiden. Reuben steps in. Reuben's still trying to claim the moral authority of a firstborn. Still thinking he can get back into Jacob's good graces. But he heard this and he rescued me out of his hands and said, let's not take his life. Let's not kill him. Let's just throw him in the pit alive. And that way his blood's not on our hands. At least not literally. Because then at least we can say, well, he was alive the last time we saw him. Us killing? Nah, not us. Reuben further said to them, shed no blood. Throw him into the pit that's in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him. We find out Reuben had an ulterior motive, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father. So Reuben had a plan. He had a plan to get back into Jacob's good graces. He had a plan that maybe he could once claim that spot of the firstborn. I rescued your favorite son, Dad. And they listened to him. So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers that they stripped off the tunic. Joseph loses his position. He loses the spot of the favorite son that's being taken from him. And they took him and they flung him into the pit, into the cistern. Now the pit was empty without any water in it. They would build, something may have been naturally occurring, but they would dig holes in the ground. They're narrow at the top, and then they'd make a cavern, so it was kind of like a bottle shape. So you weren't climbing out of it. And so that it could catch water, so then when water did come, they'd be able to go and use some of that water when they needed it. That's kind of the picture we have here. Now, this particular cistern was dry. There hadn't been any rain for a while. You think, well, oh, good. Well, he's not going to drown to death, right? But how long is he going to live without water? If they throw him into a cistern with water, he has more of a chance of staying alive until somebody comes along to rescue. And they threw him into a cistern that's dry. And then they sat down to eat a meal. What a conscience they have. Yeah? Conscience? That's what you do after you do something. You just, I worked up an appetite doing that one, boys. Sit down for lunch. And as they sat down, looked at their eyes, and behold, there's a caravan of Ishmaelites. Oh, there's the cousins. Ishmael was Abraham's other son besides Isaac. There's the cousins. What are they doing? Oh, they've been up to Gilead. They were coming from Gilead. The camels were bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh. Balm of Gilead was famous for its healing properties. I think famous enough we put it into one of our hymns. And they're on their way to take them down to Egypt. The traitors going to Egypt. And then Judah. Judah speaks up. Remember who's Judah? The fourth in line? We had Reuben, who was disqualified. Then we had Simeon and Levi.
who murdered the people of Shechem through deceit? Judas, the next in line. Judas speaks up. And it sounds like he too is having some second thoughts about actually murdering Joseph. So he comes up with a plan. I mean, Reuben's plan, he didn't reveal to the brothers he was going to save Joseph. That wasn't part of his plan. Now, Judah's plan also doesn't on this, in the way he presents this to his brothers, doesn't present any care towards Joseph. Because you can't afford to look like you care about the object of the hatred. Right? But he's apparently having second thoughts. And I think when we see his reuniting with Joseph, I think we see that this is part of his motivation here. That he's thinking that we're making a mistake here. So he says, what profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? And besides, can you really cover up blood? Didn't we learn from chapter four, that the blood cries out from the ground? That when the blood is shed, God require that blood from the hands that shed it? From Genesis 9? He said, come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our own brother, our own flesh. Let's not be guilty of actually killing him, guys. Let's just sell him off. Not that we care about him, but it's better protection for us. You know, one more removed from the crime. Not that it was any less of a capital offense, because it was. But at least the blood's not literally on their hands that way. So the Midianites are included with the Ishmaelites, more descendants of Abraham, this by Keturah, by the second wife. They passed by, and they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit, and they sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Well, let's see, there's 10 brothers, right? 20 shekels? That divides evenly. That's a good sum. Each get two. And so they brought Joseph into Egypt. And then Reuben comes back. Reuben evidently wasn't there for the lunch and the sale. He threw him in the pit, and they all sat down for lunch, and Reuben wandered off, maybe to check on the sheep. He comes back, and he goes to the pit, and Joseph's not there, and he tore his garments. And returned to his brothers and says, the boy is not there, it's me, where am I to go? This was my hope. This is my way to get in Dad's good graces. And not only am I not going to be able to be the rescuer of Joseph, Joseph's gone. What am I going to do? How can I face Dad? Can I face Dad? So they return to plans. So then they come up with plan C, which actually is a return to the original plan. We have a change of scene here. And the brothers' actions in killing and disposing of Joseph. I shouldn't say killing, they disposed of Joseph. To the deceiving of Jacob. The deceiving of Jacob. So, and I'm dropping my pages. That's okay. There we go. So they kill a goat. When's the last time we killed a goat? We killed a goat when Jacob wanted to deceive Isaac. Rebecca says, we need to deceive your son. Go kill a goat. We'll use the meat to make the stew. We'll use the fur to cover your hands and arms so you feel like Esau feels. So now they kill another goat because they need the blood to stain Jacob's tunic, or Joseph's tunic, I'm sorry. They need the blood to stain Joseph's robe. So they kill another goat. They take Joseph's tunic and dip the tunic in the blood. And they send the royal robe and bring it to their father. They said, oh, we found this. We found this. They're not saying what it is they found. We just found this piece of material out here. They're not going to name it. They despise it too much. We found this. Please examine it and see whether it is your son's. Your son has a name. Your son is also our brother. But they're not going to call him that. They're not going to own that relationship. We found this. Please examine to see whether it is your son's tunic or not. And then he recognized it. Isaac failed to recognize Judah when Judah came in. This theme of recognition and not recognition will carry through for the next couple chapters. But Jacob recognizes it and says, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. He uses the exact words that they said that they're going to tell him. Back in verse 20. They let him come up with the idea. It's much more effective to let him make the assumption than this to present it to him. Let him draw his own conclusions. And if his own conclusions, he's going to believe more readily than the ones they suggest. And so they just present their tunic, let him draw his own conclusions. And the conclusion he draws is exactly what they wanted him to draw. A wild beast has devoured him. And literally the Hebrew says, torn, torn is Joseph. So Jacob tore his clothes as an exhibition of his grief and put on sackcloth on his loins, and mourned for his son many days. Remember, this is being a little bit this is being written retrospectively to the Israelites in the desert. And in the laws, they had prescribed times for mourning, and a time of 7 days for mourning. But the implication here is that Jacob exceeded that. Matter of fact, he doesn't stop mourning. He mourns to excess. And then all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. He said, surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son. And so his father wept for him. Joseph truly was the favorite. And Jacob mourns him, as we all would mourn in losing a child. But he goes to excess. He refuses to acknowledge any comfort from having 10 sons and some daughters that are still living. After all, they aren't Rachel's kids. And so he mourns. And while he is mourning, verse 36, while he is mourning, the Midianites sold him, Joseph, in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. Jacob doesn't know it. But Joseph has been delivered to one of the most powerful households in Egypt. As a slave, he's been delivered to the one place he needs to be to learn the ropes so that 20 years from now, he will know what he needs to know when Pharaoh appoints him second in command of the whole nation. The hope is there. Jacob is lost in his grief. So who are you in this story? Who am I in this story? Are we Joseph's brothers? They've been deprived of the natural affection of our parents. They've had things go wrong in our lives. They have done nothing but respond naturally to the environment that we've been placed in. They've been consumed by their envy and hate. Proverbs 6. Go back there. Proverbs 6:16. There are six things which the Lord hates, yes, seven which are an abomination to him. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devised wicked plans, feet that run rapidly to evil, a false witness who utters lies, and one who spreads strife among brothers. How many of those are they guilty of? All of them? There's maybe one that might not fit. They react naturally to the environment they were raised in. They perpetuate and magnify the sins of their father. And it comes out in envy and hatred and in abuse. Are we Jacob? The Jacob who unknowingly, I'm not sure that's quite the word I want, but I can't find a better one, perpetuates the toxic behaviors that were modeled for him, the deceit and the lies. Were there toxic behaviors that you were raised in? I say toxic, I could use the word sinful. That you haven't bothered to examine, that I haven't bothered to examine, that we visit upon our kids, our families, those around us. We're going to face the fact that I was wrong. I need to do something different with that wrong. Because if you don't, you'll perpetuate it. The abuser often was abused. When we were first married, we had a counselor, is a pastor it was one of two people. It was either our pastor or it was another gentleman in the church who, a very godly gentleman that we respect very much, said to us, you know, if you see behaviors in the marriages of your parents that you don't like, and all you do is focus on not being that person, you will be that person. You have to face that behavior, and then you have to find a healthy model to pattern yourself after. Because if all you do is try to negatively pattern after an unhealthy model, you'll become the unhealthy model. I think that's true. Whether Jacob unknowingly perpetuated or whether he didn't realize that he inadvertently was creating exactly what had been created in his life, that's who Jacob was. Perpetuated that until it resulted in the loss of that which he most loved. His son Joseph. And he was lost in his grief. Challenge us to recognize those behaviors and to chart a new course. Are we the teenage Joseph, full of ourselves, at best indifferent to how we come across to others, at worst arrogant? Or are we the Joseph at the end of the chapter? The one that has seen the loss of his mother at a young age. He was probably 10 when his mother died. Who saw by the end of the chapter the folly and the result of his father's favoritism. He himself was sold into slavery. He was the object of his brother's hatred. He fully realized how much they hated him, I'm sure, by the time he was carried off to Egypt. Was denied the protection of his family. Threatened with death by his brother, sold as a slave. Carried off to a foreign land that he'd never known. Joseph, at the end of the chapter, is the Joseph that's lost everything. Do you feel like that's where you're at? Who are you in the story? How would you respond? Psalm 88. Close with this as I turn towards communion. Psalms. It's this big book right in the middle, right? There we go. Psalms 88. It's what we know as a psalm of lament. Could well be the type of thing Joseph was feeling at the end of the chapter. We'll see a few weeks from now when we get to Egypt, how he responds. O Lord, the God of my salvation, I've cried out by day and in the night before you. Let my prayer come before you. Incline your ear to my cry, for my soul has had enough troubles. My life has drawn near to Sheol. I'm reckoned among those who go down to the pit. I become like a man without strength, forsaken among the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you remember no more, and they are cut off from your hand. You have put me in the lowest pit, in dark places, in the depths. Your wrath has rested upon me, and you have afflicted me with all your ways. You have removed my acquaintances far from me. You have made me an object of loathing to them. I am shut up and cannot go out. My eye is wasted away because of affliction. I have called upon you every day, O Lord. I have spread out my hands to you. Closes in verse 18. You have removed lover and friend far from me. My acquaintances are in darkness. I close with that because I think at some point or another in life, that in some way represents all of us before we know Jesus. And sometimes after. We have to come to that desperate place where we know nothing is of ourselves. And we can do nothing to rescue ourselves. And all we can do is cry out to God. And the psalmist in that psalm doesn't even believe that he feels God's answer. But we can take comfort that we have a Savior who's been in that same place. Psalm 22. Psalm 22 is what we call a messianic psalm, because it reflects what Jesus went through in the garden and on the cross. And in that we can see that Jesus reflects that abandonment that we can feel before we know that God is truly with us. My God, why have you forsaken me? Far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning. Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I have no rest. That first verse, you'll recall from the Gospels as being the cry of Jesus. Yet you who are holy, O you who are enthroned upon the praises of Israel, and you are fathers trusted, they trusted and you delivered them. To you they cried out and were delivered, and you they trusted and were not disappointed. For I am a worm and not a man, a reproach of men and despised by people. All who see me sneer at me, they separate with a lip, they wag the head, saying, commit yourself to the Lord and let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, because he delights in him. Yet you are he who brought me forth from the womb. You made me trust when upon my mother's breasts. Upon you I was cast from birth. You have been my God from my mother's womb. Skip to verse 14. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaves to my jaws, and you lay me in the dust of the death. For dogs have surrounded me. A band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They look, they stare at me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. The tide changes in this psalm, unlike Psalm 80. Verse 22, I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the assembly, I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you descendants of Jacob, glorify him and stand in awe of him, all you descendants of Israel.
For he has not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, nor has he hidden his face from him, but he cries to him for help. He heard. Verse 27, all the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will worship before you. For the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. We come to the communion table this morning. We've been a lost and broken people. Maybe some of us are there today. I don't know. We come to a Savior who knows what that's like. A Savior crucified himself because of the condition of our lives. Who gave himself up to be crucified. I said that wrong, didn't I? Who gave himself up to be crucified because of the condition of our lives. We come to remember that sacrifice. But in that remembering, I'm having trouble finding my page. There it is. In that remembering, it reminds us to look to our relationship with Him. To reflect, yes, on what He has done. Would you reflect, are we truly trusting in His promise? Truly trusting in what He has done for us? 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Verse 27 says, therefore, whoever eats the bread and drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner shall be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. The man must examine himself, and in so doing he is to eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For he eats and drinks judgment to himself if he does not judge the body rightly. For this reason, many among you are weak and sick, and a number sleep. But if we judged ourselves rightly, we would not be judged. But when we are judged, we are disciplined by the Lord, so that we will not be condemned along with the world. So then, my brothers, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. Who were you in that story? Paul calls us to examine ourselves. This morning, as we come to take the cup and the bread, as you're waiting, come up as you're waiting for other people to come up after you've taken yours back to your seat before we all take together. I ask you to reflect. I specifically asked Kevin not to play this morning because I ask you to reflect in silence before God about where you are with Him. So when you're ready, go ahead and come.
Take the cup and the bread back to your seats and we'll take together.